From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, it's time for Extension 720. Now here's your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
Tonight, an indulgence in pure voyeurism. Voyeurism as a mode of psychopathology is to peek into secret and intimate scenes. But a kind of literary voyeurism is to read the private correspondence of people in whom you've got some special interest. Thus, all sorts of literary figures and all sorts of historical figures are of, if they write letters, as they all used to, these days I suppose they dictate emails, I'm not sure, but at any rate, the collection of letters, the publishing of letters, the study of letters is a very engrossing and in many ways just a wonderfully pleasant voyeuristic pastime. Though you can learn something rather serious if you analyze the letters closely. At any rate, three letter analyzers, three letter enjoyers are our guests tonight. Jonathan Gross is professor of English at DePaul University. He just brought out a book of letters by Lady Melbourne, who was Byron's Corbeau Blanc. Indeed, she was one of his mistresses. And we'll read some of those letters and a good deal else from that period. Donna Seaman, who is an assistant editor at Booklist, the American Library Association review magazine, is another one of our guests. And Larry Lipking, who is senior professor of humanities and of English and comparative literature at Northwestern University. He's the author of many works, including the forthcoming Samuel Johnson, The Life of an Author, which will be published in early next year, well, fall next year, by Harvard University Press. If there's any single letter in the annals of English letters that is best known, Larry, I should think it is the letter by Samuel Johnson to Lord Chesterfield.
Yes, this is the blockbuster letter of letters. It's an atypical letter in one way, which is that it's very composed. Most letters, of course, are spontaneous, or supposed to be. Johnson thought it was rather funny to think of letters as spontaneous, as acts of revealing yourself simply, because a letter is something which is calculated to appeal particularly to one person, and few letters have ever been more public in their idea and more calculated to offend one person than Johnson's letter to Chesterfield.
Explain the background to this one.
You know, Chesterfield had been a patron of Johnson briefly in 1747 when Johnson started his monumental English dictionary. 7 years passed, Chesterfield had not responded, and then one day in a beautiful ritzy publication called The World, Chesterfield published a sort of puff, although it was the kind of puff that's offensive too. It suggested that Johnson was a wonderful scholar, but perhaps not very genteel, and would not do a dictionary that was good for the ladies. Johnson was offended, and a few weeks passed, and then just before the dictionary came out, Johnson sent a letter to Chesterfield. Why don't I read the letter?
You must, all of it, every word of it.
My Lord, I have been lately informed by the proprietor of the World that two papers in which my dictionary is recommended to the public were written by your lordship. To be so distinguished is an honor which, being very little accustomed to favors from the great, I know not well how to receive or in what terms to acknowledge. When upon some slight encouragement I first visited your lordship, I was overpowered like the rest of mankind by the enchantment of your address, and could not forbear to wish that I might boast myself le vainqueur de vainqueur de la terre, the conqueror of the world, that I might obtain that regard for which I saw the world contending. But I found my attendance so little encouraged that neither pride nor modesty would suffer me to continue it. When I had once addressed your lordship in public, I had exhausted all the art of pleasing which a retired and uncourtly scholar can possess. I had done all that I could, and no man is well pleased to have his all neglected, be it ever so little. 7 years, my lord, have now passed since I waited in your outward rooms or was repulsed from your door, during which time I have been pushing on my work through difficulties of which it is useless to complain, and have brought it at last to the verge of publication without one act of assistance, one word of encouragement, or one smile of favor. Such treatment I did not expect, for I never had a patron before. The shepherd in Virgil grew at last acquainted with love and found him a native of the rocks. Is not a patron, my lord, one who looks with unconcern on a man struggling for life in the water, and when he has reached ground encumbers him with help? The notice which you have been pleased to take of my labors, had it been early, had been kind. But it has been delayed till I am indifferent and cannot enjoy it, till I am solitary and cannot impart it, till I am known and do not want it. I hope it is no very cynical asperity not to confess obligation where no benefit has been received, or to be unwilling that the public should consider me as owing that to a patron which Providence has enabled me to do for myself. Having carried on my work thus far with so little obligation to any favorer of learning, I shall not be disappointed, though I should conclude it, if less be possible, with less, for I have been long wakened from that dream of hope in which I once boasted myself with so much exultation, my lord, your lordship's most humble, most obedient servant, Samuel Johnson. It's been called the author's Declaration of Independence from the whole patronage system, and certainly it was a mighty historical blow to the idea of patronage.
He wrote it as a private letter, but how did he arrange for its instant publication?
Well, it wasn't published. I mean, it's a fascinating history. It became famous immediately. Chesterfield kept it on his table and pointed out the best parts to his visitors.
He was proud of it himself.
He had savoir-faire. Well, yeah. I think he was hurt, but he was too much the man of the world to allow himself to be publicly embarrassed. People knew about it. It had to be that Johnson told people about it, and the Chesterfield did. It was recited, but in fact, it wasn't published for 36 years. It wasn't published until Boswell published it just before his Life of Johnson came out in order to preserve the copyright. So it had a kind of mystery to it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the charm. It was known as a heroic deed, but wasn't immediately known as a text.
A word about the language, an appreciative word about the language.
Yes.
Jonathan, your own period in English literature isn't too much later than the period in which Samuel Johnson operates. That's sometimes called Augustan prose, is it not? It may sound a little bit alien to the modern ear, but in fact, if you listen closely or if you read it, it's wonderfully composed and it's very expressive, and it's at the same time exquisitely formal, isn't it?
Yes, the follow-up to that remark for me is, in fact, you're right to point out the connection between Lady Melbourne and Samuel Johnson. They were in different social spheres, but the Duchess of Devonshire invited Samuel Johnson to one of her literary gatherings at Devonshire House. And on that occasion, Samuel Johnson was overheard to remark about his digestion. And he was speaking about subjects that were not appropriate to the aristocratic class and his surroundings, and this was noted by the Duchess.
He always had a rather troubled digestion. So he was a great trencherman. He ate a hell of a lot.
Well, the Duchess had a wonderful remark, and I can't quite remember, but something to the effect that his eating habits were quick and nasty.
Yeah.
And he would speak about these things at length. But it was a testament to her open-mindedness that she would invite interesting people, and Lady Melbourne really guided the Duchess of Devonshire in that sense, and throughout her life patronized writers and artists.
Now, who is this Lady Melbourne that you're focused upon? Indeed, I should make clear instantly that you, that is Jonathan David Gross, have just recently had published a book titled Byron's Corbeau Blanc, The Life and Letters of Lady Melbourne. That's published by Rice University Press. She was one of his many ladies, was she not?
Well, it was deceptive, and when I started this project, I thought she was just what Margot Strickland calls one of the Byron women, in other words, mm-hmm. and a very interesting woman who he befriended. But she was much more than that, it turned out, as I went back into her life. She married Penniston Lamb, a young nobleman, and was much more intelligent than him, and was responsible for him becoming an English lord. First he became an Irish peer and then an English lord. She had affairs with a number of different important men, including the Prince Regent and Lord Egremont, who was the patron of Turner, the great painter. And so through these men that she knew in the parties...
Is the Prince Regent the later George IV?
That's right. This is George III's
son
who, in the madness of King George, plays the part of the ne'er-do-well son.
The fop who wants to displace his father.
Exactly. Yeah. And they did not get along their whole life. Lady Melbourne, in fact, contributed to try to repair that breach She sent her own son on one occasion to the to his house. But to get back to Lady Melbourne, she in her early life lived a very interesting life and befriended the Duchess of Devonshire, who was the leading Whig hostess of her generation. And it was only later in her life, when she was about 63 years old, that she began a correspondence with a 24-year-old Lord Byron. And she did it to break up his affair with her daughter-in-law, Caroline Lamb. So she's quite an interesting figure. She spans full generation, and her own daughter went on to marry Palmerston. Her son became Queen Victoria's first prime minister and introduced her to her duties.
Now, what's of interest in her letters?
Well, she's a wonderful stylist, and Johnson's prose is hard to match, but Lady Melbourne's, I think, gives us insight into what Burke called the age of extraordinary women. This was the time when women like Lady Bessborough, for instance, Caroline Lamb's mother, knew five languages and wrote a voluminous correspondence, carried on an affair with a man 20 years her junior, Lord Granville Levison Gower, who was a wonderfully impressive ambassador of Paris, a very interesting man. So she was not as extraordinary and exceptional as she seemed, though her writing was very beautiful. I could just read a little passage from
by all means
her first letter to Lord Byron.
Where her business is what?
Well, she's trying to end his affair with
Caroline Lamb.
Exactly, and she's protecting her favorite son, William Lamb, who's going to go on to become prime minister, but right now is the laughingstock of London, because Caroline Lamb is not keeping this affair private. Lady Melbourne had many affairs, but nobody really knew about them, or at least didn't dare to say so.
Byron, of course, was sort of the Frank Sinatra and Gregory Peck and what else of his time? He was...
Well, Camille Paglia compared...
Elizabeth Taylor, too. He looks quite a lot like Elizabeth Taylor.
Elizabeth Taylor. He was the ultimate sexual object of English life in the early 19th century, late 18th and early 19th.
Camille Paglia compares him to James Dean and Elvis Presley, and I think those are apt comparisons. Rebel Without a Cause.
That's far better, because he was a romantic, of course.
And the curling lip of disdain, the sense of remove, though Elvis Presley was hardly an aristocrat.
And his dashing off to fight revolutions in Greece.
Some say that, and William Hazlitt accused him of just getting a fever and making a big deal out of nothing. So that's very much disputed.
And having the effrontery to die from it besides, yes.
Right, exactly. People were very fond of calling attention to his effeminacy, which is bizarre.
But Lady Melbourne's daughter-in-law is carrying on with Byron.
Yes, and interestingly, Lord Byron liked when women dressed as men. Caroline Lamb dressed as a man to hear her husband's first speech in the House of Commons. So she also dressed as a man to meet Byron against his own inclinations. He didn't want to see her, and she would show up.
But here's Lady Melbourne trying to get her daughter-in-law out of his clutches.
Yes, and falling herself into Byron's. There's a very strange competition going on between a 63-year-old woman and a woman of about 30. I'm ashamed to think of the number of letters I have plagued you with lately. Yet instead of reforming, I send you another and an enclosure. You see how I go on trusting you and putting myself entirely in your power. Treat me generously and confess that I give you full proof that I had no secret understanding with Lady Bessborough. In my letter, I desired she would tell me her real opinion about Caroline, which she says she cannot do. I have no belief in the parts about William, unless it is that she can manage him more easily than she can any other person, and she thinks it as well to give it the appearance of fondness if he determines to remain. You are too suspicious. After all I have said, it makes me half angry. In one of your last letters, you hinted that perhaps I left your letters in the way on purpose. These are your wounding floats, and show what those persons are to expect that lie within the mercy of your wit. I cannot bear her having got that letter, whether she opened it or found it. 'Tis all one. It will be long before I forgive it. If it was either on my table or in my drawer, she has added falsehood to her other iniquities, for in that case she could not think it was for her. Well, in fact, Lady Melbourne left this letter deliberately in the way for Caroline Lamb to discover, and it's very interesting to discover that later on. I'm just going to skip down to one other part where Byron has been flattering her, and she refers to this. What high-flown compliments you have paid me. For heaven's sakes, lower me to my proper level, or I shall be quite alarmed when I see you again. I shall neither dare speak before you nor to you, and as to talking my usual nonsense, that must be quite out of the question, as I shall soon drop from this pinnacle where you have placed me. Do let me down easily. that I may not break my bones by a sudden fall. What can you have in your head, men of distinguished abilities? Ce sont des hommes comme les autres, and I am a woman comme les autres, superior in nothing. I happen, fortunately, to be gifted with a fund of good nature and cheerfulness and very great spirits, and have a little more tact than my neighbors, and people call me pleasant because I am always inclined in conversation to enter into the subjects that seem most adapted to the taste of those with whom I happen to be, when they are not too high for aspiration. And here, of course, she's referring to Byron himself. And she ends the letter just by saying that she hopes in the end that they will be known as good friends. If imperious circumstances had not prevented it, once you told me you did not understand friendship. I should say that again. Once you told me you did not understand friendship, I told you I would teach it you, and so I will, if you do not allow Carolyn to take you quite away. Do you remember some verses of Voltaire? And she goes on to quote Voltaire. And I think what she's doing here really is trying to impress Byron, not only with her reading, he hardly needed to be impressed. Everyone knew about her cultivation. But she is quoting more often than she ever did again in writing to Byron. She became his most intimate confidant.
Did she become an intimate friend in that sense of intimacy?
He said her conversation was champagne to his spirits. And even after she died, he remembered her in his own poem in Don Juan as Lady Pinchbeck. And very fondly, too. So he could never...
Yeah, but I'm asking something. Speaking of country matters, did they go to bed at any point?
No, they didn't. It's hard to establish this, but Leslie Mitchell's new biography of Lord Melbourne, which just came out from Oxford University Press, suggests, without evidence, that they did. And I've seen people line up on both sides. His new book, after all, is actually wonderful, and it has a lot of new information. But that can't be documented. And... it's less interesting, I think, in some ways than the erotic relationship that developed between them. And Eros was really what was going on.
Who has Mary Wortley Montagu?
I've got some.
We've got some commercials coming, but she's yet another figure of that period who lived a most unusual life. Donna, who do you have from that period?
Oh, not from that period. I'm modern.
We'll take a modern touch next. Before we go to the commercials, tell us who you've got coming up.
Gertrude Stein.
Gertrude Stein.
Yes, speaking of complicated women.
Gertrude Stein is Gertrude Stein
roles.
Is Gertrude Stein.
Yes, exactly.
Unless
Gertrude
she's
Stein
Alice Toklas.
Is a surprising mentor to Thornton Wilder.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's talk about Gertrude and hear some of her letters. Do they scan a little bit more easily than her literary efforts?
No, they're quite the same.
Well, we'll examine one or two of those directly after these words.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Now, back to Milt Rosenberg.
We're looking in on the lives of various well-known people through their letters. So far, it's been literary figures, and indeed it will continue for a while to be literary figures. Now, Gertrude Stein is the most unusual person. Let's talk a bit about her life before we even talk about her work and examine a letter. She was, as you know, to begin with, a psychology major at Harvard, and her professor was William James.
And
around
right.
the turn of the century.
Well, she started out in California, of course. Quite an interesting family. She and her brother Leo eventually made it to Europe. Gertrude Stein, I guess, got tired of school, tired of medical school. I think it cramped her style. She wasn't one to follow other people's lead. Went to Paris and with Leo began looking at art and started sort of a salon with writers and artists and was just outrageous. I mean, she was a real
The phrase lost generation comes from her. She says to Hemingway, if this is true, you are in the early 1920s, you are all of you a lost generation.
That's right, but she was, I guess, helping find them, painted by Picasso, established Matisse.
Famous portrait of hers by Picasso,
very famous,
of course.
Yes.
Now, say, how would you describe to those who've never read her literary style? It drives many people up the wall.
Up the wall. It's very, it's like chanting to me.
It sounds,
it's almost childlike, very repetitive. It's paradoxical. She sort of goes in circles. It takes a while to get used to it.
She's the author of the famous epigram, if that's what it is, a rose is a rose is a rose.
Yeah, she wrote a book called Three Lives about three different women. Mm-hmm. And she blurs many boundaries. She's written books about Paris and books about America. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be travel books, and they turn into these sort of little incantations about, you know, she's driving, about there's a hill, there's a house, then there's a bit of history.
About America, her greatest line is about Oakland, California, where she says, there's no there there. That's often applied to many other
places.
And persons. There's no there there.
That's right. There's no there.
So you've got a letter of hers.
Yes. There was a book published of letters between Gertrude Stein and Thornton Wilder. Mm-hmm. A very interesting pair. At the time they met, Stein was 60, well-established. She'd come back to America and gone on a triumphant lecture tour. Thornton Wilder had just won the Pulitzer Prize, and he was a very straight-laced and uptight sort of fellow, and somehow he
also
found
also a closeted homosexual.
He had a lot to hide.
Which made him very stiff in the sense of being formal and unrevealing.
Very good point, considering Gertrude and Alice lived so happily together. Mm-hmm. And Gertrude, she was very matronly and took him under her wing, and they started corresponding after they met in America. And she writes these letters in her typical style. Here's a little bit of one of them. This is to Thornton. There you are, and here we are, and we wish we were where you are, or you were where we are. Anything like that is completely beautiful. This is how she babbles. Thornton Wilder writes back to her very newsy letters, very straight ahead, very conservative, and she keeps writing back. It isn't always easy to see why he's so turned on by her. But this is an interesting little incident. At the close of one letter, Stein, who's always very affectionate, had written, God bless our little Thornton and make him stout of heart and loving is his nature. God bless him, all of us. Well, she uses a small g for God. Wilder replies to her, in Gertrude's prayer for my success, Gertrude spelled God, which he capitalizes, with a small letter, but he was not offended. He did what she asked. Stein writes back, oh, no, no, no nice God could mind a small g. They know that a small g is natural. In his next letter, Wilder, ever the obedient and grateful student, begins his letter, God with a small g, willing, I shall be with you soon, and I am looking forward to it with a wild bound. Uh-huh. So he responded quite quickly to her influence. She, at one point, tried to convince him that they could teach a course together at the University of Chicago. Uh-huh. Actually, and here's her course plan.
Thornton Wilder was a close friend of Robert Hutchins, the president of the University of Chicago. They were undergraduate students together at Oberlin. And the most revealing things from Hutchins are in his letters to Wilder.
To Wilder.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
They are used by Harry Ashmore in his biography of Robert Hutchins.
Well, here's a course plan for University of Chicago. Now, I'm not sure what she thought she was teaching, but here's what she suggests. I am writing some little short things about newspaper writing and detective story writing, and I think of you. I am full of meditation about narrative and how it can be written, and every solution is a solution, and I think of you. That is really what I want the course to be, our course. Just to find out how narratives should be written, are written, can be written, may be written. It kind of worries me how they were written, have been written worries me less, but this other thing does worry me. Quite a lot of worries me, and sometimes I know, and mostly I don't know, and I think of you both ways I think of you. I am now writing about American education. Well, anyway, I do think of you, and it is nice to think of you here in New England as well as elsewhere.
Makes you feel like screaming after
a little bit.
But she was estimated to be a serious literary figure. Is she, in fact, a serious literary figure, or does she just have one trick, which, namely, this sort of echolalia running off in constant repetitions of a word?
No, she's one of the giants of the 20th century. If you think of writing as being an experimental effort to try new things, uh-huh. If you feel that making it new and trying to change the nature of language itself is what a writer's business is, then
in stream of consciousness. I mean, she and James Joyce are working. Yes.
And it is, of course, interesting to note, isn't it, that the very term stream of mm-hmm. consciousness comes from her teacher, William James, who in those days, when she was his student, was doing his, at least was revising his first major psychology text, the first general psychology text written in this country, in which the stream of consciousness and the flow of consciousness is one of the main conceptual frames that he employs to kind of reconstitute a Scientoid image of what a human being is, yeah. or what human mentality is. Mm-hmm.
Something that Lawrence Lipkin brought up reminds me of, really, in some ways, she held a salon, and in that way she reminds us of the 19th century and the 18th century, where it's a danger, I think, of the 20th century to measure people solely as individuals, and certainly Byron had a lot to contribute to that individualist myth, but the salon is a place where people could gather and learn from each other, and in fact Sheridan borrowed some of his best lines in School for Scandal from Lady Melbourne. Some lines are taken directly in the character of Lady Teazle. And even someone like Rahel Varnhagen, who invited Camiso to her gathering. She was a Jewish woman who would not have been allowed in Berlin society, and yet somehow, like Lady Melbourne herself, managed to cross a line between respectability and literary interest and gathered under her roof interesting figures. So that sense of collectivity is really wonderful about Stein. I've always really appreciated her interdisciplinarity, the fact that she cultivated artists. And it's then everyone just wants to go back and say, well, what did she do? But that shouldn't be lost. Pound, for instance, played that role.
Yes.
People lead to people lead to people. Rachel Varhagen was, of course, also the subject of the first book written by Hannah Arendt.
Wonderful
study. It was Arendt's doctoral dissertation, possibly, was it?
It's very dense, though. There's been, a work just published in Yale University Press by a woman that is a little more readable. Arendt's book is brilliant, but if you want to know about her as just a historical figure, and she was fascinating, yeah. Especially her cultivation of figures like Camiso, who wrote this wonderful little story about a man who lost his shadow. Of Peter Schlemiel, which is playing off of Schlemiel, the Yiddish. But that was just the main point, is that even figures like Duchess of Devonshire, because they cultivated artists, and people like Reynolds would come to their gatherings, not just literary figures, but figures in political society.
Well, it's interesting, too, that groups, circles like that generate a lot of correspondence. These people were so used to communicating that when they were apart, they wrote a lot of letters. I mean, and everyone turns up in everyone else's letters. I have letters of Hemingway's here complaining about Stein, and there's letters of hers about him, and that salon and circle context.
Letters are very close to conversation at their best. It really gives you the illusion, at least, of listening into some of the very best conversations.
All of these so far have been private letters, though they turned up publicly, or they wouldn't, or we wouldn't be able to read them tonight. There's another interesting category, letters written for public presentation, most commonly letters to the editor, sometimes by aggrieved but well-known people. A prodigious writer of letters of grievance was the great modern novelist Graham Greene. And there is a volume, I got it a few years ago, Graham Greene, Yours, Etc., Letters to the Press by Graham Greene. Here's one by Greene written to the London Daily Mirror on in 9 January 1948. It's about the film version of his famous sort of detective horror novel, Brighton Rock. And he says, I have read the somewhat violent attack by your critic, Reginald Whitley, with bewilderment. If he had said that the book, Brighton Rock, was, quote, false, cheap, nasty sensationalism, end quote, it would have been, to me, a quite possible personal point of view. But to praise the author of the book at the expense of the directors of the film is surely unbalanced. As it happens, I am also the author of the film play, and I can assure your critic that John Bolting, the director, while his twin brother Roy was producer, worked quite as hard as myself to retain the religious theme. And modifications of that theme are the responsibility of the British film censor, who objected to various passages in the dialogue of a specifically religious nature. Apparently, one is allowed a certain latitude in using the name of God as an expletive, but any serious quotation from the Bible is not permissible on the English screen. But in spite of this handicap, I should have said that what your critic describes almost too kindly as, quote, the subtle religious theme, end quote, was as present in the film as in the book. Mr. Whitley remarks that, quote, Hollywood has banned the production of gangster films because they give a false impression of life in America, end quote. But in fact, Hollywood has not banned the production of gangster films, but only the production of films that hold the gangster up to the sympathy of the audience. Obviously, this has not been done in the case of Pinky Brown, and your critic's disgust is an indication that one purpose of the film, the presentation of a character possessed by evil has been successfully achieved. Naturally, parents will not want their children to see it. Must all films be made for the juvenile market? Nor would they be allowed to take their children to it without breaking the rules of the cinema, since the picture has been granted only an adult certificate.
Yes.
Interesting, isn't it?
Green spent time as a film critic himself. That comment, that comment about the juvenile is particularly strong, since he was exiled, virtually exiled from England for making nasty and prurient remarks about Shirley Temple.
Do you remember the exact quote about Shirley Temple?
Not by heart. I don't have it by heart.
There is a volume, Green on Film, mm-hmm. which reproduces all of his film reviews, and that one is highlighted, of course.
Yes, well, I sympathize with him because I remember that Shirley Temple was one of the banes of my youth. She was a perfect little girl, and why couldn't I be a perfect little boy?
He suggests in that famous review that there is something quite seductive and quite coquettish.
Yes.
And sexualized.
Which is true. I mean, if you look at the films today, it's clear. I mean, let's not get into this subject, but there is a certain famous case in Denver which is very reminiscent of Shirley Temple prancing around.
Oh. Mm. Well, speaking of authors and movies, I have a quote from a letter from Hemingway to Maxwell Perkins.
His famous editor.
Famous editor and very dear friend. Mm. This series of letters is called The Only Thing That Counts. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. It starts out for months and months, Mr. Perkins, Mr. Hemingway. And all of a sudden, they drop the misters, and they become closer. But this is still in the Mr. Perkins stage. Half these letters are about money. I mean, Hemingway's just fanatic
about
the business
side. Somebody once said most writers' letters are about
Absolutely.
Money.
Absolutely. And money and drinking and all that. But, dear Mr. Perkins, this is December 6, 1926. Thanks so much for the reviews and the information about the Suns, the Sun Also Rises, prospects. As for movie rights, please get the best you can, i.e. the most money. I do not go to the movies and would not care what changes they made. That is their gain or loss. I don't write movies. Just give me the money.
Simple Hemingway prose.
Yes. Oh, it's full of them. Would you like to hear a little
Please,
more?
Please, yes.
This is a later letter. Now it's Dear Max. This is in 1934. And he's in Key West, where he was very, mm-hmm. very happy. But he's tormented by this problem of money and writing. And here's a little bit of a manifesto. This is a bit into the letter after the dollar amounts are out of the way. But I am a careerist. As you can read in the papers, Hemingway took criticism very hard. And my idea of a career is never to write a phony line, never fake, never cheat, never be sucked in by the YMCA movements of the moment, and to give them as much literature in a book as any SOB has ever gotten into the same number of words. But that isn't enough. If you want to make a living out of it, you have to, in addition every so often, without faking, cheating, or deviating from the above, to give them something they understand and that has a story, not a plot, just a story that they can follow instead of simply feel, the way most stories are. The story is there, but I don't tell it to them in so many words. I knew it then, too, but because I had taken the damned advice, I thought, what the hell, that's good enough for them and more, they won't know. But what the hell? I'm a professional, and professionals learn by their mistakes instead of justifying them.
It's interesting that he calls himself a professional, because Byron really took issue with that in his own letters. He thought that writing was not a profession, but a calling.
Okay.
And that professionalization of literature really bothered him. He said to his own publisher, John Murray, "Pay your tradesmen, I am none." And he had a sense of himself as an aristocratic author. He wouldn't take money for his work. He made a point of that until he wrote Don Juan, and then he began to ask for money. And in fact, he used to quote The Merchant of Venice in his letters to exaggerate. He felt so uncomfortable in this new role that he would pretend he was Shylock and exaggerate his demands for money, wishing that his mother-in-law would die so he could get her an inheritance. Mm-hmm. And this sort of thing. But one thing that strikes me about Hemingway, in fact, there's a connection, obviously, again, with Byron in some ways, in the self-dramatized. I don't mm-hmm. believe for a minute what he says about being honest and telling the truth and all this stuff.
It's very,
very American.
Making a myth here.
Right.
No,
all
and
these it's a nice
letters.
Myth.
Yeah. Yes.
But one thing that strikes me about letters is that the egotism, you know, mm-hmm. you can't be, I don't think, a good writer of letters if you don't have a very strong sense of your own importance. And Byron certainly carried that. But it's also who the letter is going to. There's one little short passage where he says at the end of a long letter to Lady Melbourne, my head is a little disturbed today. I have to write first a soothing letter to Caroline, a sentimental one to XYZ, a sincere one to Thomas More, and one a mixture of all three to yourself, with as much of the ludicrous as you like to find in it. And that brings me just to this idea that, I mean, Byron wrote in very different styles, depending upon who he was addressing. And I wonder if that's the same
chameleon.
With Hemingway, if he took on that sort of pugnacious tone.
You mentioned that his involvement with his own publisher, John Murray. As a matter of fact, one letter I wanted to read, I just came upon this recently, is by Herman Melville, who a little bit later on is involved with the same John Murray, a major publisher in England. Typee, which may have been Melville's first book, I think it was. It's an account of his adventures as a Yankee sailor when they landed in the Marquesan Archipelago. It's rather a sexual book. It's full of interesting mm-hmm. adventure.
Oh, yes. Yeah, racy stuff.
And it's about to be done up in England by John Murray, but obviously Murray has raised certain questions about whether Melville, who's written a novelized but supposedly factually based account of a sailor's trip to the Marquesas, whether in fact Melville was ever there.
He had a stake in this because his firm had been known for writing travel literature, publishing travel literature.
Murray's
beginning
firm.
With Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, which was, of course, the grand tour of Albania and Greece. So he wanted these things to be accurate.
So he's worried about that with this Yankee back in... because actually Melville is in New York City, isn't he, at mm-hmm. that time, rather. Though he's also up around Pittsfield, Massachusetts. But here's Melville's answer to Murray's query, September 2nd, 1846, long before he's done Moby Dick, of course. He says, you ask for documentary evidences of my having been at the Marquesas in Typee. Dear sir, how indescribably vexatious when one really feels in his very bones that he has been there to have a parcel of blockheads question it. No, let me hurry to tell you that Mr. John Murray comes under that category. The category of blockhead. Oh, no, Mr. Murray, I am ready to swear, stand fast by the faith, believing Typee from preface to sequel. He only wants something to stop the mouths of the senseless skeptics, men who go straight from their cradles to their graves and never dream of the queer things going on at the Antipodes. I know not how to set about getting the evidence of his having been to the Marquesan Islands. How under heaven am I to subpoena the skipper of the Dolly, who by this time is the Lord only knows where, or Cory, who I'll be bound, is this blessed day taking his noon nap somewhere in the flowery vale of Typee, some leagues, too, from the monument. Seriously, on the receipt of your welcome favor, dear sir, I addressed a note to the owners of the ship, asking if they could procure for me a copy of that part of the ship's log which makes mention of two rascals running away at Nukaheva, to wit, Herman Melville and Richard T. Green. As yet, I have nothing in reply. If I think of any other kind of evidence, I will send it if it can be had and dispatched. Is he fooling around with this guy? Is he amusing himself? Or is this sincere, I wonder? Makes you wonder whether he was ever, in fact, in the Marquesas.
Oh, well, he did sail around the world. There's no doubt that
he had a travel.
And he wrote several more books, his most popular books.
Umu is the same.
Yeah, yeah, Redburn's a nice one.
Yeah.
He knew a lot about what it was to be a young sailor. One of the themes we seem to be picking up is grievance. letters are very good at expressing grievances and litigation even. And I thought I might join that with our earlier talk about the movies and try some Groucho Marx. A letter that Groucho Marx wrote about Casablanca. When the Marx brothers were making a movie called A Night in Casablanca, Warner Brothers heard about it. And they wanted very much to know what the plot was, but they never found out. And Groucho Marx, having been approached by their lawyers, wrote this to Dear Warner Brothers. I can't really do the delivery, but here's Groucho Marx.
Flick a cigar, maybe.
Apparently, there's more than one way of conquering a city and holding it as your own. For example, up to the time that we contemplated making this picture, I had no idea that the city of Casablanca belonged exclusively to Warner Brothers. However, it was only a few days after our announcement appeared that we received your long, ominous legal document warning us not to use the name Casablanca. It seems that in 1471, Ferdinand Balboa Warner, your great-great-grandfather, while looking for a shortcut to the city of Burbank, had stumbled on the shores of Africa and raising his alpenstock, which he later turned in for a few hundred shares of the common, named it Casablanca. I just don't understand your attitude. Even if you plan on re-releasing your picture, I am sure that the average movie fan could learn in no time to distinguish between Ingrid Bergman and Harpo. I don't know whether I could, but I certainly would like to try. You claim you own Casablanca, that no one else can use that name without your permission. What about Warner Brothers? Do you own that too? You probably have the right to use the name Warner, but what about Brothers? Professionally, we were brothers long before you were. We were touring the sticks as the Marx Brothers when Vitaphone was still a gleam in the inventor's eye. And even before us, there'd been other brothers, the Smith Brothers, the Brothers Karamazov, Dan Brothers, an outfielder with Detroit. And Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? This was originally Brothers, Can You Spare a Dime? But this was spreading a dime pretty thin. So they threw out one brother and gave all the money to the other one and whittled it down to Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? He goes on at great length.
I'll go on a little bit more. It's wonderful.
Now, Jack, how about you? Do you maintain that yours is an original name? Well, it's not. It was used long before you were born. Offhand, I can think of two Jacks. There was Jack of Jack and the Beanstalk and Jack the Ripper, who cut quite a figure in his day. Uh-huh. As for you, Harry, you probably sign your checks sure in the belief that you're the first Harry of all time and that all other Harrys are imposters. I can think of two Harrys that preceded you. There was Lighthouse Harry of Revolutionary fame, and a Harry Applebaum who lived on the corner of 93rd Street and Lexington Avenue. Unfortunately, Applebaum wasn't too well known. Last I heard of him, he was selling neckties at Weber and Heilbrunner. He then goes on about the Burbag Studios, Luther Burbag, Warner's
Wonderful
finally,
stuff.
And ends by talking about their lawyers have caused all the trouble. They won't get away with it. We'll fight them to the highest court. No pasty-faced legal adventurer is going to cause bad blood between the Warners and the Marxes. We're all brothers under the skin and will remain friends till the last reel of a night in Casablanca goes tumbling over the spool.
That's wonderful stuff. What is that from?
It's from the Oxford Book of Letters, edited by Frank Kermode, came out a few years ago. Very rich and sort of eclectic collection of British letters. It's what Kermode likes. He leaves out many of the famous ones because they're too well known, and he puts in all kinds of cranky ones.
Marx is a great stylist, and he writes sort of the way he performs, I would say.
Yes, it sounds to me as if he probably dictated it, in fact, and had somebody else do the typing. He wasn't a great typist.
Wonderful stuff. We've got some possibly wonderful stuff of a different order coming up. A quick round of messages and then directly back. But before we go to those, what's coming up next? Who else are we going to read? What
would
are the
like
letters?
Would we like to stay in one more humorous, in the humorous
Absolutely.
Space?
Which one do you have
White?
E.B. White?
E.B. White.
He's scheduled. Who else is scheduled?
I have a bitter writer, Theodore Dreiser.
Dreiser's bitterness.
And I'll go to Lady Mary Wortley Montagu as advertised.
We mentioned her earlier. All of that and more to follow after these words.
You're listening to Radio 720, WGN Chicago, a Tribune broadcasting station. Welcome back to Extension 720. Again, your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
Hello, Mother. Hello, Father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner. He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters.
That's a little surprise supplied by our producer, Julie Truman. That, of course, is Alan Sherman, who was a fine entertainer, died perhaps about 10 years ago. He was on this program in the early days of this program. And that's his letter from camp.
A classic.
to the tune of The Dance of the Hours by Ponchielli from La Gioconda, which everyone in the control booth knew and was easily able to identify, I am informed. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think we should keep laughing. Why not? Letters can be very sad. They can also be very amusing, especially with the pen of E.B. White, a brilliant stylist, a longtime New Yorker editor, author of children's books, Charlotte's Web, Stuart Little. He likes animals.
Considered one of the great American essayists by all sorts of people.
He's wonderful. And,
also an expert on the use of the language. He took Strunk and updated it, did he not?
Yeah, Strunk and White.
Yeah.
Still a standard today. So, a responsible man, loved animals. In 1951, he said, I'm being accused in New York State of dodging my dog tax. And apparently this got out of hand, so he wrote a letter to the ASPCA. Dear sirs, I have your letter, undated, saying that I am harboring an unlicensed dog in violation of the law. If by harboring you mean getting up two or three times every night to pull Minnie's blanket up over her, I am harboring a dog, all right. The blanket keeps slipping off. I suppose you are wondering by now why I don't get her a sweater instead. That's a joke on you. She had a knitted sweater, but she doesn't like to wear it for sleeping. Her legs are so short, they work out of a sweater, and her toenails get caught in the mesh, and this disturbs her rest. If Minnie doesn't get her rest, she feels it right away. I do myself, and of course, with this night duty of mine, the way the blanket slips and all, I haven't had any real rest in years. Minnie is 12. In spite of what your inspector reported, she has a license. She is licensed in the state of Maine as an unspayed bitch, or what is more commonly called an unspaded bitch. She wears her metal license tag, but I must say I don't particularly care for it, as it is in the shape of a hydrant, which seems to me a feeble gag, besides being pointless in the case of a female. It is hard to believe that any state in the Union would circulate a gag like that and make people pay money for it. But Maine is always thinking of something. Maine puts up roadside crosses along the highways to mark the spots where people have lost their lives in motor accidents. So the highways are beginning to take on the appearance of a cemetery, and motoring in Maine has become a solemn experience when one thinks mostly about death. I was driving along a road near Kittery the other day thinking about death, and all of a sudden I heard the spring peepers. That changed me right away, and I suddenly thought about life. It was the nicest feeling. You asked about Minnie's name, sex, breed, and phone number. She doesn't answer the phone. She is a dachshund and can't reach it. But she wouldn't answer it even if she could, as she has no interest in outside calls. I did have a dachshund once, a male, who was interested in the telephone and who got a great many calls. But Fred was an exceptional dog. His name was Fred. And I can't think of anything offhand that he wasn't interested in. The telephone was only one of a thousand things. He loved life. That is, he loved life if by life you mean trouble. And of course, the phone is almost synonymous with trouble. Minnie loves life too, but her idea of life is a warm bed, preferably with an electric pad and a friend in bed with her, and plenty of shut-eye night and day. She's almost 12. I guess I've already mentioned that. I got her from Dr. Clarence Little in 1939. He was using dachshunds in his cancer research experiments. That was before Winchell was running the thing. And he had a couple of extra puppies, so I wheedled Minnie out of him. She later had puppies by her own father at Dr. Little's request. What do you think about that for a scandal? I know what Fred thought about it. He was some put out. Sincerely yours, E.B. White.
Mm-hmm. Nice man,
yes.
E.B. White. Very well regarded. It's a gentle sort of humor. It's hardly
exactly,
a heavy
very
yacht
dry.
Kind
right.
of humor. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu was quite an eccentric, as I remember it.
Yes, well, she was a great woman. She was, an amazing talent of a writer, although most of her writing was letters. And letters were a major form in the 18th century.
And she was a great traveler as well, was she not?
Yes, she went to Turkey. In fact, she introduced inoculation for smallpox into England. She discovered it in Turkey and published Turkish letters, which were very famous at the time. And had an independent life. She taught herself to read Latin when she was a child because she would not take anything for granted and wouldn't accept all the restrictions placed upon women. She married for love. It turned out not well, but she went her own way. And then her last years were sad in many ways. She got fascinated by a younger man who turned out. Not to be interested in women, and she pursued him to Italy and spent her last years there. But in many ways, it's fortunate because everywhere she went, she wrote letters. She and Horace Walpole are probably the two great newsmongers of the 18th century. It's a way of letters, of course, are a wonderful historical
record. What are her dates? She's also sort of a Regency figure, isn't she?
Yeah, she was. She died. No, she's in the early part of the 18th century. She died in the 1760s.
Oh, so she's earlier than I
remember. Yeah, that's right. Why did I read a little of her sensational Turkish letter? She visited both a harem and a Turkish bath. Uh-huh. And published about the harem. Here's an unpublished letter, unpublished at the time, which is about her visit to a Turkish bath. Nice ladies did not do that at the time. The next room of this bath is a very large one, paved with marble, and all round it raised two sofas of marble, one above another. There were four fountains of cold water in this room, falling fast first into marble basins and then running on the floor in little channels made for that purpose, which carried the streams into the next room. Something less than this, with the same sort of marble sofas, but so hot with steams of sulfur proceeding from the baths joining to it, 'twas impossible to stay there with one's clothes on. I was in my traveling habit, which is a riding dress, and certainly appeared very extraordinary to them, yet there was not a one of them that showed the least surprise or impertinent curiosity, but received me with all the obliging civility possible. I know no English European court where the ladies would have behaved themselves in so polite a manner to a stranger. I believe in the whole there were 200 women, and yet none of those disdainful smiles or satiric whispers that never fail in our assemblies when anybody appears that is not dressed exactly in fashion. They repeated over and over to me, "Uzel, pek uzel," which is nothing but charming, very charming. The first sofas were covered with cushions and rich carpets on which sat the ladies, and on the second their slaves behind them, but without any distinction of rank by their dress, all being in the state of nature, that is, in plain English, stark naked, without any beauty or defect concealed. Yet there was not the least wanton smile or immodest gesture amongst them. They walked and moved with the same majestic grace which Milton describes of our general mother. There were many amongst them as exactly proportioned as ever any goddess was drawn by the pencil of Guido or Titian, and most of their skins shiningly white, only adorned by their beautiful hair divided into many tresses hanging on their shoulders, braided either with pearl or ribbon, perfectly representing the figures of the graces. I was here convinced of the truth of a reflection that I had often made, that if 'twas the fashion to go naked, the face would be hardly observed. I perceived that the ladies with the finest skins and most delicate shapes had the greatest share of my admiration, though their faces were sometimes less beautiful than those of their companions. The lady that seemed most considerable amongst them entreated me to sit by her and would fain have undressed me for the bath. I excused myself with some difficulty, they being all so earnest in persuading me. I was at last forced to open my skirt and show them my stays, which satisfied him very well, for I saw they believed I was so locked up in that machine that it was not in my own power to open it, which contrivance they attributed to my husband. I was charmed with their civility and beauty and should have been very glad to pass more time with them, but Mr. Wortley resolving to pursue his journey the next morning early, I was in haste to see the ruins of Justinian's church, which did not afford me so agreeable a prospect as I had left, being little more than a heap of stones.
What a wonderful thing. Yes.
You know, she's full of style, Lady Mary, and writes on a lot of different subjects, too.
What does she have to say about the harem?
Well, the harem is fairly similar. There she's talking in public. She published the Turkish letters, and they really were written for a public. They were written to be published. There's a considerable difference between letters of that kind and letters that are written only for a friend, partly, although Lady Mary's letters are so good that they can appeal to anybody.
I have a letter that actually Montesquieu wrote to her. It's in French, so I won't read it, but it places him in England at that time. And what you say about letters being written for publication, like Pope's in some ways were revised,
yes,
is very, very much different. People say that even Byron's letters, Sainsbury said that they were he was in a prepared state of undress. And I think that's very much the case when a writer knows that they're a public figure and they're writing for that audience. But Montesquieu's Persian letters, in some ways, is... I find it somewhat dull because it doesn't seem to capture the casualness of Walpole's letters, which you alluded to earlier. Walpole is so wonderful as a letter writer because you never know what he's going to say next. He's so spontaneous. He goes from one topic to another, which is something Lady Melbourne also shares with him. There were a number of connections. I mean, Lady Wortley Montagu is a very interesting figure who in some ways precedes Lady Melbourne's own role in that society. Another woman, of course, is Madame de Stael, who visited England.
Yes.
And Lady Melbourne, though she did not publish herself, was a very shrewd observer of human character. And I think at the end of the 18th century, that was what the women whose letters I've read, the aristocratic women, really had as a special gift. Here she talks about and reveals a trait, and that was, I think, what they meant to do in these letters. She talks about Madame de Staël, who it appears spoke very loudly at parties and really liked to be heard. I'm not sure this is as funny as the Groucho Marx letter, but it gives you a sense of a different type of humor. I want to just read a little bit from how she banters with Byron. And of course, she's bantering with an egoist here, who still has a sense of humor about himself, which is what makes Byron's letter so witty. She says that that Byron might envy the Prince Regent the visit he's going to make. Lady Melbourne loved to show off about all the wonderful, illustrious guests she had at her party. The Prince Regent would dine at 4 a.m. at her house, come over by horseback from Carlton House, and people were very jealous of that. They had a friendship for about 25 years, which gave Lady Melbourne tremendous control over government. At various moments. But in any case, she describes a party where Monk Lewis attended, and Monk Lewis was trying to talk to Madame de Staël. What odd things happen. Lewis and Mrs. Fitzherbert, that's the Prince Regent's mistress, Catholic woman who he actually married secretly. The Prince Regent was a bigamist. He had two wives. Yep. Both of these people, Lewis and Mrs. Fitzherbert, have both proposed themselves to me, not knowing he was coming, the Prince Regent. The first of the two tells me he quarreled at Oatlands with Madame de Staël. She was in a passion. He laughed. She said his laughter, showed he was inferior, mais très inferior. She talked loud, so did he, and the singers at the other end of the room could not hear one another and were obliged to stop. I wish I had seen it. There never was such a person for tracasseries as she is. There are two in love now with Caroline. She goes on to talk about that. Then in her next letter, she picks up the theme of Madame de Staël. I think she was slightly jealous of Madame de Staël because she was this formidable intellectual who had published Corinne, who was opposing Napoleon, who was in exile, very self-dramatizing, as was Byron. And she, in some ways, wants to show that she's superior to Madame de Staël, that she's a more important correspondent or confidant than Madame de Staël might become. She didn't need to do this because Byron detested Madame de Staël. He said she was a woman who always had ink in her mouth and a pen behind her ear. We detest authors who are all authors.
Yes, did not keep him from swiping some of her stuff, I'd have to put in.
Oh, what are you thinking of?
Well, I think actually he gained... I think the Byronic hero is a version of Madame de Staël's Corinne. I think that's very, very influential upon him. He changing the woman to a man, which he was very good at doing.
ACDC
all the way.
When you talk about feminism and the shape it's taken in this latter day, she's a very important person also, isn't she? There are in the 18th and early 19th centuries women who really assert themselves in a very strong way, including very often the insistence upon dressing as men. Though de Staël didn't do that. She tried to make herself attractive in the conventional feminine sense, but she wasn't really a very good-looking woman, as I remember it.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But she maintained this vast salon, which had tremendous influence.
Well, she dressed as Sappho, and she tried to, as Corinne models herself on that.
Yeah.
Byron tried to reduce her to her physical appearance. In fact, in unpublished lines, he talks about her arms were pretty, but this and that. But he had to admit, she befriended him, in fact, tried to reunite him with his wife after they separated when they met together in Switzerland. This was at the time when Mary Shelley was writing Frankenstein, and Madame de Staël had gathered around her circle a whole group of English emigres, including Lord Brougham, who had given a very negative review to Byron's first edition of poems. But he liked her in the end. She was a very good friend to him, even though he could not quite handle a woman who had that much force.
Has upper society, the society of the bien connu of the savants, and as well as the glittering people, has it always been sort of rich with scandal, rich with betrayal, rich with intense use and misuse of other people?
It certainly wasn't ancient Rome.
It was in ancient Rome, and it was in Regency England.
Yes,
it is today.
In the 17th century French court, it's immortalized forever by the person the French think is the greatest of all letter writers, Madame de Sévigné, who writes brilliant artificial letters, and in fact still is influential on French prose to the present day. Proust was very influenced by Madame de Sévigné.
Most of Madame de Sévigné's letters are to her daughter.
Yes, that's right. She was widowed young, 25. Yeah. And
they're reports from the court, aren't they?
That's right. She tells you everything that's going on at the court and manages to keep you reading in volume after volume, which shows her gift for gossip.
Is it the court of Louis the 14th?
Yes, the Sun King.
The Sun King. The other guy who's really carrying on about the court and gives us a good sense of it is Saint-Simon.
Yes.
More or less at the same time.
Yes, that's right. As long there are little bits of wonderful malicious court gossip going back as far as you can go back. Even Elizabethan letters, which are not plentiful, will give you a very different view of what was going on behind the scenes and in bed.
Where do we first begin to use? From what period do we first get letters which are of historical utility?
Well,
you don't really have them from Greece, but you do have them from Rome.
Well, the fact, and then you're going back further than I was. Right. Cicero, obviously.
Cicero
talks about a description.
Pliny the Younger. There's that wonderful letter. There's a vast correspondence, but that wonderful letter by Pliny the Younger when he's sent off to some godforsaken portion of Turkey to be the governor, and he writes back to the emperor, it's Trajan at the time, I think, and he says, we have a lot of these Christians, so-called, around here. What do you want me to do with them? Should I kill them or what? And Trajan writes back and says, no, just make them confess me as a god. If they bow to my statue in the temple, then leave them alone. Otherwise, kill them only if they make a lot of noise as Christians. And that's Christianity in the first century A.D. And it's just gives you some fascinating insights into the situation of Christians in that first century.
In fact, women's literature, the idea of a heroine, at any rate, is tied up with letters, because the heroine was invented, the word was invented by Ovid in the Heroides, and all of the Heroides are love letters written from women to the heroic men who have left them for one reason or another, Penelope to Odysseus, Medea to Jason.
And interestingly, when it comes to letters, in English literature, the epistolary novel is really the first form of modern or quasi-modern novel, isn't it?
Right.
And those are letters written by Pamela.
Is it Pamela and Clarissa?
And Clarissa.
Yes. Yes.
Richardson's early novels,
right,
which are epistolary novels, and they go on for volumes and volumes and volumes. Yes. And they have to do with all the travails of a noble and decent woman badly treated by men and badly treated by her husband.
This makes me think of Virginia Woolf and the whole Bloomsbury circle, and they were very busy letter writers.
Yeah.
And
we are very busy commercialists. Every so often, we are supposed to pause, and we're overdue right now. So we do pause for some commercials, and then directly back. We still have Theodore Dreiser coming up, and who else?
Oh, how about some Vincent van Gogh?
Vincent van Gogh,
painting.
That impassioned torture artist, both before and after he sliced off his ear.
And I'll throw in a little Abigail and John Adams.
Oh, very nice.
Great correspondence. We'll return directly after this.
Extension 720 continues now on Radio 720 WGN. Again, Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to Jonathan Gross, professor of English at DePaul University, author of, or editor of, what does one say in this case?
Editor.
of Byron's Corbeau Blanc, The Life and Letters of Lady Melbourne, Rice University Press, the publishers, Donna Seaman, editor for Booklist magazine, that's published by American Library Association, and a regular contributor to the Chicago Tribune book section as well, and Larry Lipking, who is the Chester D. Tripp Professor of Humanities at Northwestern University, author of many works, and forthcoming is Samuel Johnson, The Life of an Author, that will be out in the fall, published by Harvard University Press. Theodore Dreiser, I'm rather fond of Dreiser. Who's got him and why?
I had Dreiser, we'll see if I can pull him up quickly. The part I was alluding to was a dispute he had in the publishing of Sister Carrie, and I was struck by the change in tone in going to the 20th century. The letters are much shorter, they're written on a typewriter for the most part. I learned a lot just by looking at the handwriting. The size of a letter can tell you a lot. In fact, in some ways, it governs.
Of course, now they're emailed and they run one paragraph.
And that changes the writing style, too.
Of course,
even the grammar, or lack thereof.
Yeah.
The sense of exclamation that you, or immediacy, spontaneity, you can't call back an email. You can't think about it. But Dreiser's letters really give you the sense of someone who's on the outside of the literary world. And struck me as sad as his heroine, who people often say that he wrote Sister Carrie about himself, and or about his sister, his own sister, who apparently had run off with the man who tended bar, much in the same way that Hurstwood runs off with Sister Carrie. But Dreiser, this is not humorous, of course, what I'm going to read is a short letter by Arthur Henry to Theodore Dreiser, July 14th, 1900. He describes trying to convince Doubleday to publish Dreiser's novel. And I think it gives you a sense of the trials and tribulations writers go through in trying to get their work out. Yesterday, I had a hot time up at Doubleday and Page's. In talking with Norris, this is Frank Norris, he suggested that I see Lanier and ask him when he was going to publish your book, as they ought to be getting about it. I asked Lanier, and he said that he didn't know, that he'd only been back a little while and hadn't got around to it yet. Norris also suggested that I speak to Lanier about changing the names of all those real people to fictitious ones. Lanier wants all of them changed. He don't want Froman or Daly or the real names of newspapers or any of those things. The fact is that Lanier is a good deal of a cad. He knows nothing at all of real life. His nature is very shallow, and he's exceedingly conceited. We had a very warm argument on the subject. He said that all those things seemed to him like a straining after realism. I told him that anyone who could get such an impression from that book must in the nature of things be mistaken, because I knew for certainty that there had been no straining for realism, and that, on the other hand, were the names of Froman and Daly and the newspapers to be changed, that here would be an actual straining, and that, in my opinion, were you to do it, you would stultify yourself. And what you see in these letters is the real anxiety, the worry that, mm-hmm. that he's going to have to change his novel to get it published. It took tremendous integrity, and of course, Dreiser had a nervous breakdown as a result of the refusal to publish the book or to put 500 copies in the basement of Doubleday, because apparently, as the myth goes, Doubleday's wife didn't like the morality of the work. And Doubleday himself was a bit of a cantor, as Byron might have said, someone who really bought into hypocrisy and didn't understand a great work of literature was precisely one that was going to break through those hypocrisies.
So far, we haven't had any letters by truly evil persons, have we?
No.
Truly evil.
Truly evil.
Bitchy, perhaps, yeah. But not
bitchy
evil.
Bitchy isn't truly evil.
Bitchy yeah. is very good quality to deliver.
I offer you the greatest murderer of the 20th century, according to some who've studied genocide through this century, namely Yosef Vissarionovich Djugashvili, otherwise known as Stalin. Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating book. Now that they've opened the archives in Moscow, some interesting stuff is coming out. And this is from the Yale Archives, Russian Archives Project, one of the first publications out of that project. It's edited by three Russians. Stalin's letters to Molotov, which were unearthed. Now, Molotov was Stalin's loyal lieutenant from the very beginning. And he was one of the few lieutenants that Stalin didn't kill. Molotov was, in a way, his confidant, as Stalin planned to kill and develop cases against almost all the other old Bolsheviki. Here, way back in 26, Stalin is still veiled, but he's struggling against Trotsky and against the various others, and ultimately he's going to kill them all. By mid-1930s, he's killed them all except Trotsky, who has escaped, and he sends an agent to track Trotsky down, and he worms his way into Trotsky's entourage in Mexico City, a guarded mansion, and that guy lives there for a few years, and then one quiet afternoon splits Trotsky's head open with a hatchet from behind him, of course. But all of that is to come. Here is Stalin still veiling himself just a bit, but writing to his intimate Molotov. Comrade Molotov, this is 23 September 1926. I've received your letter of 20 September. One, regarding wages. I think you've got it fairly well. It's important that the lower strata receive something tangible. It would also be good to give something to the oil workers. They do not get very much on the whole. That's routine stuff, I guess. But then, two, if Trotsky, quote, is in a rage and thinks of, quote, openly going for broke, that's all the worse for him. It's quite possible that he'll be bounced out of the Politburo now. That depends on his behavior. Stalin is beginning to exert full control over the Politburo. The issue is as follows. Either they must submit to the party, they being Stalin, Trotsky's group, or the party must submit to them. It's clear that the party will cease to exist as a party if it allows the latter possibility. Three, as for Smirnov, another one he killed later on, after the warning that he has already had, only one thing remains, expel him, at least temporarily. Four, I think that the plenum cannot, quote, gloss over the question of Medvedev. Perhaps you have a means of glossing over. If so, tell me what it is. Five, perhaps you are right that the question about the opposition bloc must be raised at the conference. Still, we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. Better to observe how that bloc will behave now. Six, you and Bukharin must hurry up with your speech on the question of the August bloc. There's no reason to wait now, I think. Bukharin is another one he kills later on. And he goes on and on, laying out positions to take about all these other Bolsheviks that he doesn't trust, all of whom he later, on the basis of sheer paranoia, destroys. It's interesting, there is a quotation from some other source of Stalin having said one night after he signed, he and Molotov together sign orders for the extermination of some 700 or 800 people, all of whom have been convicted or brought up before the NKVD or its predecessor organization. He then gets off the line. There's nothing more lovely than to consign all of your enemies to death and then go to a dreamless sleep. That's sort of the peak of human happiness, says he. You got any other letters from evil people?
Evil people.
Evil people.
No.
It's a special topic, to be sure. I don't know that we have any letters by Hitler, do we, at all? I've never seen, there have been some manufactured, some faked ones, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we have any authenticated letters. Though perhaps some of our listeners know otherwise. We are opening the phones right now. I should have done this sooner. The number, of course, is 591-7200. If you've got questions to raise or information to offer, do give us a ring. If you know anything about Hitler's literary legacy, whether he actually wrote letters which remain, he must have written letters, but whether any of them have been unearthed and published, I would love to hear about it. 591-7200. And if you got a letter you want to read, not from your grandfather, but from some person known to the world, we'd be interested in your contribution. Let's get some other contributions from our guests. What's next up?
Well, do we want to hear from a painter? We've been hearing
yes,
from
you
all
mentioned
sorts
Van Gogh,
of literary
by all means,
people.
Yes.
I'm going to go
call him Van Gogh or Van Gogh or Van Gogh?
Well, I say Van Gogh. I don't know.
The Dutch
we're
going to
go from a monster of Stalin to an exalted being who.
But a trouble, a tormented
very
one.
Troubled,
a
yes. Tormented one. He's writing to his brother Theo. Vincent was too porous to the world. Beauty mm-hmm. made him, you know, radiant and excited, and then he would tumble back down. But reading his letters, it just shows you that he was an incredibly lucid and expressive man. And when he writes to Theo about landscapes, you can see his paintings. So here's a letter from May 1876. Did I write to you about the storm I watched not long ago? The sea was yellowish, especially close to the shore. On the horizon, a streak of light, and above it, immensely large, dark, gray clouds, from which one could see the rain coming down in slanting streaks. The wind blew the dust from the little white path among the rocks into the sea and shook the hawthorn bushes in bloom and the wallflowers that grow on the rocks. To the right, fields of young green corn, and in the distance, the town, which, with its towers, mills, slate roofs, Gothic-style houses in the harbor below, between two jetties sticking out into the sea, looked like the towns Albert Durer used to etch. I watched the sea last Sunday night as well. Everything was dark gray, but on the horizon, the day was beginning to break. It was still very early, and yet a skylark was already singing, and the nightingales in the gardens by the sea. The same night, I looked out the window of my room at the roofs of the houses you see from here and at the tops of the elm, dark against the night sky. Above the roofs, a single star, but a beautiful, big, friendly one. And I thought of us all, and I thought of my own years gone by and of our home, and these words and this sentiment sprang to my mind. Keep me from being a son who brings shame. Give me thy blessing, not because I deserve it, but for my mother's sake. Thou art love, cover all things. Without thy constant blessing, we shall succeed in nothing. You can really
oh, that's very moving.
Feel his yeah. passion, yeah. how much color in yeah. the world.
It's amazing
meant
to remember that in his lifetime he sold literally no
oh,
paintings.
Oh, nothing, yes, yes.
His, I guess suffered. Vincent bought them.
Theo bought them.
Rather, yeah. Theo bought them from Vincent.
Sent him yeah. money, yeah. followed, sent him money wherever he rambled. I mean, Vincent was just sort of a pilgrim to beauty. He just went from uh-huh. place to place and just celebrated it as best he could. But yes, he was very poor.
Let's hear one more letter
lonely.
Of his. Do you
oh,
have another?
Yes, I do. This is a rather lovely one. This is much later, 1888. Again, my dear Theo. You see, I have never had such luck before. Nature here is extraordinarily beautiful. Everything and everywhere. The dome of the sky is a wonderful blue.
Where is he writing from in this one?
Oh.
From down in Arles or something?
Yes, I believe he is.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, these letters, are not a lot of information here. The dome of the sky is a wonderful blue. The sun has rays of a pale sulfur, and it is as soft and delightful as the combination of heavenly blues and yellows and Vermeer of Delft. I cannot paint as beautifully. Vermeer, of course, was so precise. But it absorbs me so much that I let myself go without giving thought to a single rule. That makes three pictures of the gardens opposite my house, then the two cafes, then the sunflowers, then the portrait of Bach and myself, then the red sun over the factory and the men unloading sand in the old mill. Leaving the other studies aside, you can see that there's been some work done. but my paint, my canvas, my purse are completely exhausted today. The last picture, done with the last tubes of paint on the last canvas, is of a garden, green by nature but painted without any actual green, nothing but Prussian blue and chrome yellow. I am beginning to feel completely different from the way I did when I came here. I no longer have doubts. I no longer hesitate to tackle things, and this feeling could well grow. But what scenery? So he's struggling. He's poor. He's running out of paint.
But he's
not going to stop.
There's the burning painter's eye, obviously.
Absolutely.
He sees everything.
He sees, he feels it. There's letters in here where he describes the miners and the potato eaters.
Really?
That he
paints. That goes back to one of his very first paintings.
Yes, very early, and he describes them in great detail. And I don't know, to me his language is as strong as his brushwork.
I've never read that book. I know it exists. What is it titled?
It is called...
My Dear Theo or something?
The Letters of Vincent Van Gogh. This is a Penguin Press edition, a larger edition than some of the earlier, more complete.
We need to catch up with our commercial load. We'll do that right now. 591-7200 is the number. Now's the time to give a call if you want to read us a letter, ask about letters, pursue something or other broadly related to the letter as... literature, not as fictional literature, but as reflections of reality and as windows into the lives, secret or otherwise, of people of some interest. 591-7200. Get your calls in right now if you are so inclined, and we will return directly after these words.
And now the conversation continues on Extension 720 from Radio 720 WGN. Here's Milt Rosenberg.
And we will go directly to the phones for a few calls at least. 591-7200 is the number, and here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Back in college, I was obsessed with the life, the poetry, and especially the letters of Emily Dickinson. And back then, I would have done anything to own just one letter of hers. And I was wondering, the letters of the famous in literature, are they pretty much owned by universities, or do they ever come up for auction?
Oh, they do come up for auction, and private people of some wealth do collect them. I had a friend who was an American popular writer, Irving Wallace, who in his home in Los Angeles had wonderful letters all mounted on his walls. He probably spent a few million dollars collecting those letters. They went as far back as a letter from Dickens, as far forward as letters from Faulkner, but many, many others, as well as historical figures, not just writers. And he wasn't a man to brag much, but I think his wife may have suggested to me that he had spent over $2 million or so in building that collection. So it isn't a poor man's game.
No, but it is possible to own letters by famous people. It's one of the problems that editors face when they try to put together collections of letters. They're necessarily dependent upon going all over the world and begging letters from people who may have inherited them through their families.
Well, how did that work for you, actually, Jonathan? Where were most of your letters located?
They were actually all over the world, mostly in England. And I was actually at Christie's Auction House, which I'd recommend to the caller if he's looking to find letters. They have a catalog. Their catalogs are actually available at the Art Institute of Chicago. But I was in Christie's in London. Lord Ralph Kerr had put the Melbourne papers up for sale, and I went to the Lovelace papers at Oxford, which is actually the subject of a Henry James short story called The Aspirin Papers, and a number of other places, Huntington Library and estates, record offices. Hertfordshire Record Office is a great place for that. And the English are really wonderful at writing back. I got 66 illustrations in my book in large part because the English were willing to, as they always have been, great letter writers, and they correspond punctually and sent photographs and copies, Xeroxes, when they could to save me a trip. One interesting place was Chatsworth, a wonderful estate of the Duke of Devonshire, which is still owned by that family, and they're curators of these places.
You can sometimes pick up at an auction something like a note from Arnold Bennett to his tailor, send me another dozen of those shirts, or something like that, for a mere $300 or $400.
There are also forgeries. I mean, Byron's letters are notoriously forged fetched a great price. In fact, one of his biographers has a whole book called My Caravaggio Style, in which it's a fictional account of how a young man who's down on the heels writing literary biographies and tired of it tries to forge a Byron letter to make his his reputation, and it ends disastrously.
Our number, 591-7200. There is space available on the board. If you want to call us, now is the time to move quickly and do so on 591-7200. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
This group is very fascinating. I wonder if you have any opinion about the use of handwriting analysis or so-called graphology. Does it have any value in...
Well, I guess that's one of the ways that you discriminate a forgery from the real thing.
Right, but further, going into the dots and loops, you know, and reading character through that, is there any validity to that?
The most interesting loop I came across was the D that Lady Melbourne wrote. It was the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen. It was a literal loop that went halfway across the page, and once I figured out her D's, I could understand her letters, but one of the reasons her letters have remained unpublished is because, as Virginia Murray put it, a descendant of John Murray, she said that no one could crack the code. And I was so insecure, I actually brought a British person along with me to read these letters in the British Library, thinking that because she was British, she could somehow read the handwriting better, which was, of course, mistaken. But it's amazing, though, if you do look at them, and her letters are fairly hard to read at first, you get a good night's sleep, go back the next day, and after about 3 or 4 days, you can read fairly clearly things that were once impossible. I wish I had had that course, but you can do it yourself. Self-taught is sometimes the best way.
We thank you for the call, sir. Yes.
Oh, I was just going to continue with that.
Please do.
There's been quite a few studies about handwriting as indicative of personality. There's a recent book, I cannot think of what it was called, but a lot of it's used as evidence in court cases.
Well,
a lot of psychiatrists.
Graphology is
right.
Is the term for that science. There are some who argue that you can't really read anything. Just as Shakespeare said, there's no reading the mind's construction in the face. Many critics say there's no reading the mind's construction in the handwriting.
It's particularly different historically, too, because you have to become an expert on handwriting in a way if you're editing any earlier literature. But just the difficulty of making out an Emily Dickinson letter requires a great deal of training of the eye. And what the letters mean in the first place, in the literal sense, is the main problem.
Proper names are the hardest thing, because if you don't know all her acquaintances, then you don't know who the person is. And cross-writing was done as well. Mary Shelley's letters, if they couldn't frank their letters, which means they go for free if they're aristocrats or lords, they would save money by writing one way and then turning the page and writing another way. And Shelley did this, and his letters are impossible to read for that reason.
Here's a letter I got for you from one of the most valuable people who ever lived in this century, a great writer and also a great letter writer, and there's a vast correspondence from him available. It fills many volumes, namely George Bernard Shaw. And here's a totally trivial letter, but I find it interesting directly and also for one special reason, which I'll explain later. What I find directly interesting about it is that here again is a writer complaining about not getting enough money and not being properly interpreted by those who are doing something with his work. He's writing to Kenneth McGowan, who was, at the time of this letter, 1933, a story editor and associate producer at RKO Studios. And he, namely Shaw, is writing at sea in the Caribbean on the RMS Empress of Britain. And he says, "Dear Kenneth McGowan, I got your wireless on the high seas and intended to see you at Hollywood about it. But as luck would have it, I missed San Francisco and Los Angeles and Hollywood. Except for an hour or so at Culver City with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, I was either at W.R. Hearst's ranch or in the air all the time. You will find that RKO doesn't mean business when it comes to the point." They've been trying to get him to sell him some of his plays to make films out of them. "They held me up for a year over Arms and the Man when they were operating in London through Basil Dean, and I shall not take up the question of Brass Bound or Candida, two of his major plays, with them until I have some evidence that they know what they are doing. Somebody has told them that I am a man with a publicity name and a story to sell them to play with. They think all they have to do is say how much and toss me a check, spelled in the English style, C-H-E-Q-U-E, of course, and then hand over my play to the bellboy to arrange as a movie with spoken subtitles and a salting of kisses and socks on the jaw. In spite of the promising work done by Arliss in the serious screening of plays as such," that would be George Arliss, the English actor, I think, "I don't believe that Hollywood is within 10 years of tackling my stuff. And the British experiments with it are hopeless. They have no money and want to put it, and want to put in minutes mostly wasted where months are needed. Faithfully, G. Bernard Shaw." It's interesting that, this is 33, I guess it is about 43, that they do film is, which one is it?
Major Barbara.
Major Barbara. Mm-hmm. I think it's filmed during the war in this country.
Yes, they're cut, of course, and Shaw is a wordsmith. He believes in words. Very few movies believe in words, with the possible exceptions of the Marx Brothers movies in Casablanca.
One other thing that fascinates me about this is that he's writing to Kenneth McGowan, who was then a pretty young man, I suppose, and working, as I said, as the story editor at RKO. The first article I ever had published in a more or less professional journal was published by Kenneth McGowan, who, towards the end of his life, around 1961 or 62, was the editor of something called the Hollywood Quarterly. And I had done a little piece on Mr. Magoo as Public Dream. I did it as a speech when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, and somebody thought it might make a nice article, and I contacted McGowan about it, and I sent it to McGowan, and he accepted it. So this man that Shaw is writing to later on wrote to me. You can connect yourself that way. It's like 6 degrees of separation.
That's right.
Yes.
Back to Julius Caesar, I suppose. We've got a few more commercials waiting, I believe, and room for more phone calls on 591-7200. First, these words.
You're listening to Extension 720 on Radio 720 WGN. Once again, Milt Rosenberg.
Now then, time is short, and so we apologize. We'll take no more calls because there's still loads of letters. Simply your favorites, something you wouldn't feel decent about if you had to go home not having read it. You would
toss and turn
all night if you hadn't read this letter.
Let me give you the real story of the American Revolution between John Adams and Abigail Adams.
Wonderful.
Abigail was the letter writer who had to teach him about real life while he was off writing the Declaration of Independence. This is one from 1776.
Well, he didn't write the Declaration.
Well, he helped you write it. He helped to draft it, actually. He was one of the drafters. While he was doing this, she was in Boston, and this is what she wrote. I long to hear that you've declared an independent city. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be much more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. That your sex are naturally tyrannical is a truth so thoroughly established as to admit of no dispute. But such of you as wish to be happy willingly give up the harsh title of master for the more tender and endearing one of friend. Why then not put it out of the power of the vicious and the lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity with impunity? Men of sense in all ages abhor those customs which treat us only as vassals of your sex. Regard us then as beings placed by providence under your protection, and in imitation of the supreme being, make use of that power only for our happiness. And he replied by saying this must be a plot. As to your extraordinary code of laws, I cannot but laugh. We have been told that our struggle has loosened the bands of government everywhere, that children and apprentices were disobedient, that schools and colleges were grown turbulent, that Indians slighted their guardians, and Negroes grew insolent to their masters. But your letter was the first intimation that another tribe, more numerous and powerful than all the rest, were grown discontented. This is rather too coarse a compliment, but you're so saucy I won't blot it out. Depend upon it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. Although they are in full force, you know they're a little more than theory. We dare not exert our power in its full latitude. And he ends by saying he begins to think it's all a government plot. After stirring up Tories, land jobbers, trimmers, bigots, Canadians, Indians, Negroes, Hanoverians, Hessians, Russians, Irish Roman Catholics, Scotch Renegados, at last they have stimulated the ladies to demand new privileges and threaten to rebel.
Wonderful stuff.
They were a loving couple. I mean, that isn't fun. That
is tongue-in-cheek. But
that isn't fun, although it might not be read that way by everybody today.
Yeah.
We haven't read love letters today.
He wrote some love letters.
He did write love letters. Yeah. Abigail was the better letter writer, as I said. There are a lot of wonderful love
letters. Does anybody have a good love letter?
Well,
I taught
La Nouvelle Louise, but it doesn't play very well anymore because Sam Pro's letters are so romantic that the students didn't find it very interesting. I do have a kind of anti-love letter, or a seduction letter, I should say.
Let's hear it.
This is, in fact, Lady Melbourne was compared to Madame de Merteuil in La Close, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, and Byron was compared to Valmont by their contemporaries. In fact, Antoine Morois, in his introduction, makes that comparison. And here is a letter in which they really live up to the reputation. Byron was in his best friend's house, a man named James Wedderburn Webster, and he began, through no fault of his own, to start to seduce his friend's wife. In these last few days, I have a good deal of conversation with an amiable person whom, as we deal in letters and initials only, we will denominate PH, and that's for friend, the courtesan of Roman times. Well, these things are dull in detail. Take it once. I have made love. And if I am to believe mere words, for there we have hitherto stopped, it is returned. I must tell you the place of declaration, however. A billiard room. I did not, as Caroline says, kneel in the middle of the room, but like Corporal Trim to the nun, I made a speech, which, as you might not listen to it with the same patience, I shall not transcribe. We were before on very amiable terms, and I remember being asked an odd question, how a woman who liked a man could inform him of it when he did not perceive it. I also observed that we went on with our game of billiards without counting the hazards, and supposed that, as mine certainly were not, the thoughts of the other party also were not exactly occupied by what was our ostensible pursuit. Not quite, though pretty well satisfied with my progress, I took a very prudent step with pen and paper in tender and tolerably turned prose periods, no poetry, even when in earnest. Here were risks, certainly. First, how to convey, then how it would be received. He's worried that his friend is going to find him corresponding with his own wife. It was received, however, and deposited not very far from the heart which I wished it to reach. And you remember from Dangerous Liaisons, the whole point of that novel is that Valmont is trying to get letters. And then it closes by talking about this metaphor of billiards and chance. And he says, my billiard prospered, it did more, it even reached her. And she gives him some advice on how to handle the relationship.
I'm a little bit unclear. I gather they did not get down to ultimates.
He says he spared her in the end.
He spared her.
And he's like Valmont that way because he resists. He's not just a libertine.
Some words of love from Emily Dickinson.
Okay.
Will you let me come, dear Susie, looking just as I do, my dress soiled and worn, my grand old apron and my hair? Oh, Susie, time will fail me to enumerate my appearance, yet I love you just as dearly as if I were e'er so fine. So you won't care, will you? I am so glad, dear Susie, that our hearts are always clean and always neat and lovely. Not to be ashamed. I have been hard at work this morning, and I ought to be working now, but I cannot deny myself the luxury of a minute or two with
you.
Who
is Susie?
Susie Gilbert married Emily Dickinson's brother later. Yeah. There's some speculation as to their affection.
Is
this
really?
Is a lovely letter. Yeah. Yeah.
We
very
are out
tender.
Of time. It's been a lovely program, and I thank you very much for joining us. Our guests have been Donna Seaman, from Booklist magazine, as published by the American Library Association, Larry Lipking, professor of humanities at Northwestern University, and Jonathan Gross, professor of English at DePaul University, whose new book, Byron's Corbeau Blanc, The Life and Letters of Lady Melbourne, is just published by Rice University Press. I must tell you a few things about programs to come. Tomorrow night, Dinesh D'Souza, who's done a virtually hagiographic biography of Ronald Reagan, will be our guest, and Matthew Rothschild, the editor of Progressive Magazine, who totally disagrees about the administration of Ronald Reagan, will be with us as well. Thursday night, we talk about the best and the worst films of the year with Penelope Messick, with John Patrakis, and with Eugene Phillips. That's all to come. There's also an interesting program on Friday about the authors of a book titled Honey, Mud, and Maggots. The point there is that old home remedies sometimes work very well, and there are good medical reasons why they do. That's all to come for tonight. Time only to say thanks again to our guests, thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night.